The rest of you, if you'd be so kind, and stand with me as God's people stood at the foot of a mountain as they encountered God, and we too, even in the 21st century, he promises wherever two or three are gathered to encounter us through his word, his body, and beginning in verse 1 of John. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was with God in the beginning. Through him, all things were made. Without him, nothing was made that has been made. In him was life. That life was the light of all of humankind. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness has not overcome it. These are the very words of God. You may be seated. We've been, or at least last week we started to, talk about how in world religions there's many, many different gods. And I said last week there's no such thing as a generic one. And this is true not just with religion. This is true in all of the ways that we perceive the world. Whether, you know, whatever lens you use, it doesn't have to be a religious lens, it could be a socioeconomic lens, it could be a political lens, it could be, maybe you only see the world through a rational, hardcore, scientific lens. Maybe that's the only lens you use when you see reality. It doesn't matter whether it's a religious lens, whether it's a, what we would call a non-traditional, because they're technically all religious lenses in some ways, there is no such thing as a generic lens. There's no such thing as a generic God. There's no such thing as a generic perception, because they're all going to have distinctively different ways of answering some pretty important questions, like who are we as humans? Why are we here? And I don't mean like in Sheboygan, though that might be a good question this time of year. Why are we existing rather than not existing? And then, is there such thing as a way to live? Like, and by that I mean we could just, you know, go short and just say morals. Are there such things as morals? And if so, where do those come from? Do they come from somewhere? How do you know they come from somewhere? And what does that mean, that there's a way to live rather than, you know, why is loving better than putting somebody again in a gas chamber? Who decides that? And then, is there any hope? Do we have any hope? And I mean collectively, not just you personally, as human beings, is there any hope? And depending on what lens you see the world, they're all going to answer that pretty significantly different. And among the world's sort of buffet of options, the God who shows up in this story, the God of this story, the God who shows up wrapped in a manger, the God of the Bible, I think has a fundamentally unique way of answering those questions. And not just answering those questions, I think the way in which this story answers those questions can fundamentally change the way we see the world. Change the way we see culture, change the way we see society, change the way you see yourself, change the way we see others. I think this story has that capacity. And if there's one thing we said last week that makes this God uniquely different, is that this God is deeply personal. And I don't just mean, again, that he just cares for you, though he does. I mean that, again, to steal from C.S. Lewis, when you go behind the thing that is behind the thing that is behind the thing that is behind the thing, the source of everything, when you stare, whatever that source is, this story tells us there's a concrete personality there. There's a concrete person. We would identify that person, of course, as God. Behind everything, behind energy, behind matter, behind space, time, you'll find there a person. Colossians, again, very similar to John, puts it beautifully and succinctly. He is before all things, and in him all things hold together. John puts it, without him, everything that has been made, yeah, that's not being made. None of it exists. Now, that's not to say that the God of this story is the only God that has a personality. I mean, we could just go into the ancient Greco-Roman world and you would find there all sorts of different gods. You could even say the Romans, I mean, and the Greeks, they had more gods than Pez dispensers, right? Like, literally. If you don't know what a Pez dispenser is, ask your parents and then ask them out on the way home to buy you one. They're great dispensers of all things processed sugars straight to the bloodstream. But a lot of people collect these things. And in some sense, the ancient Greco world collected these personal gods. They had a god for pretty much everything. And I'm going to quote Paul in my own sort of language. But in Acts 17, if you recall, Paul's like, man, you guys are religious. Like, you guys have gods all over the place. You have this god. What's this god over here? And he actually sees a god. Right? He goes, I even found an altar, a god, within this inscription. This one doesn't have a name. This is an unknown one. Tell me about this one. And he doesn't say, tell me. He tells them. Let me tell you a little bit about this unknown God. And he uses it as a door to walk through. But the argument that he makes there and the argument that I'm making is what makes this God, the God of this story, distinctly different isn't that he's just one of many options. And that's not what Paul was arguing. He wasn't arguing this God is one of many options, just like we have Athena and Zeus and Poseidon. This God is one of those, and so this one's the better one rather than those ones. That's not what he's saying. He's saying, and I'm saying, this God, who is behind everything, doesn't rely on anything outside of himself. This God doesn't rely on anything outside of himself to exist. He's before all things. The theological term for that is this God is absolute. He doesn't depend on anything for his existence, not you, not me, nothing, not time, not space. Last week I said this God is deeply personal, and that's true. There's a person, there's a personality behind the one who's at the core of everything. But it's also that he's absolute. He's not dependent on anything. And typically, the world, depending on what story you live by, now the truth is every person has a story. Whether that person's aware of their story, and maybe their story is just about them and what's going on in their interior world or external close proximity, but you won't meet a person, and you're one of them, that doesn't live by a story. Everybody has to live by a story, so everybody has a story, but the truth is, typically, depending on what story you live by, depending on what religion you live by, it typically will force you to choose between the two. Between the impersonal, like everything is vast, we live in a vast, sort of unsafe universe, asteroid could wipe us out at any moment. And this vastness, this absolute world that we live in is pretty terrifying when we actually think about it. That's an option. So there's an absolute sort of existence that is a combination of three things, matter, time, and a lot of time, and what we might call random chance. Or, in the face of that vast universe, you could go the opposite direction. You could choose the more personal. And you see this with all sorts of religions, right? This is why you find within Hinduism, and Hinduism doesn't believe in many gods. They believe there's one God who manifests himself like 350 million times over. And these personal gods are, you know, there's a personal God for, you know, showering, a personal God for, right? You could go either the big route, the vast absolute universe route, or you could go the personal route or even the religious route. And in some sense, therapy, the therapeutic psychoanalytic story is this way. In the face of a vast universe, I'm just going to focus on my real self, like, because that's pretty scary to think about the absolute world that we live in, or reality. Now, at first glance, this doesn't seem that terrible of a choice, to go either the vast absolute route or the personal route. Doesn't seem that bad. But the truth is, we need both. They're both necessary. If we're going to have such things as universal laws, if we're going to have such things as universal morals, if we're going to have such things as universal laws that we use for calculations to build bridges and to do space exploration, we're going to need absolute. But it's also true we're going to need the personal. You're going to need the personal and the personal God, if we're going to have such thing as humanity, such things as compassion, such things as love, such things as relationships, such things as meaning, such thing as hope. You're going to need actually both. And the truth is, the Bible never forces us to make a choice between those two, the impersonal versus the personal. In fact, I would even argue it's a false choice. This story speaks of God's absoluteness. He's not dependent on anything, and he's behind everything, including the laws of the universe. But he's also a concrete person who interacts, who makes promises, who relates, and keeps those promises that he makes. And the truth is, this story says that this God can never be separated. Now, at this point, you might be saying to yourself, I hope you're saying to this self, Rick, this sounds pretty much up there in theory land, or thought world, or the world of concepts. And you would be right, but here's why I bring it up. Christians down throughout the ages have made the point that God's absoluteness, his universality, his stability, his order has always been the basis for things like scientific study. We need those things. And the sciences have always relied on this, by the way. The sciences have always relied on the assumption that the universe is relatively stable. It's relatively predictable, if you will. We can sort of see it and perceive things and make calculations that actually work, like laws of gravity, these types of things, right? Even like the ways in which you perceive reality. If you were to drive past a field of cows, and then you were to drive past that field of cows 5 minutes later, you would never have the thought that, wow, those cows could vanish at any moment, or those cows could teleport to a happier place like California this time of year. There would never be a thought in your mind that those cows could just disappear on you. There's a kind of predictability that comes with the ways in which you see the world. This is true with weather. I can say with somewhat accurate sort of prediction, like you wouldn't think I'm crazy if I said sometime around May, and that might be pushing it, sometime around May, it's going to get warm again. Like, and again, I might be pushing it, but you wouldn't think I'm nuts to say that, right? And then it's going to trick us all over again. This is the best place in the world. And then 6 months later, we're like, whoa, what's happening? But you're with me when I say, you know, by May, we might experience warmth. Again, this could happen, right? This type of predictability, this kind of stability, this way of perceiving the world where you can actually make some judgments about is what caused folks like one Albert Einstein, who born Jewish, but then became, some people argue whether he's a deist or Christian, but he said this to one of his students. He goes, I want to know. I want to know how God created this place. I'm not interested in this or that phenomenon or in the spectrum of this or that element. I want to know God's thoughts. And the rest are just the details. I think many folks aren't even aware in our culture, in the West, or even we take for granted how fundamentally the pursuit of science and understanding this world and even the universe was deeply guided by assumptions that this story makes concerning who God is, his absoluteness, but also his universality, his order, and so forth. In fact, even the premise that this universe can be somewhat investigatable is a massive assumption that historians of natural philosophy, historians of natural science, have said has been behind really Western technological and sociological development since the Middle Ages. And while, yes, there's been other scientific cultures, and there have been lots of other scientific cultures who had different religions, different gods, who developed highly developed things like alchemy, it was because of this story and the assumptions that this story makes that in the West that developed into something that we call today chemistry. And this is true with other things, right? There have been other scientific cultures who worshipped other gods, and they developed things like astrology, where they, you know, they saw the ways in which the planets interacted with seasons and in our lives as human beings. But in the West, because of this story and the assumptions that it makes, it developed into something today we all call astronomy. So historians of natural philosophy, historians of natural science alike have all stated, many have stated, that there is a distinctive feature, there's a distinctive feature of the scientific revolution that gets its foundations, not just from implicit religious considerations, but actually explicit religious considerations, ones that Einstein here even spoke to his student about, out of which the wonder of modern science is born. Now, the fact that the Bible, this story, and the God of this story, and the story of the world brought about the foundations for scientific discovery and investigation, that's a pretty wonderful thing. It's pretty neat, actually, when you think about it. And I don't think many people in the West today, maybe some, but aren't even aware of that background. But here's the thing. It's only half of the story. It's not the whole story. We see in John, the one whom he says, without God, this God, nothing has been made, is also, again, a concrete person, a concrete personality who speaks, who acts, who interacts, who enters into these promises, who keeps those promises, who's born in a manger, who calls his people to himself, who calls his disciples, who comes through on his promises, which, by the way, also, and I know this might sound strange, also gives legitimacy for the study of things like the humanities, things like the arts. And here's what I mean. If this God is, in fact, a personality who makes promises, who interacts, who has a relationship with us, then personalness matters. And the reason personalness matters is because this God cannot just be reduced to, say, a mathematical equation. This God cannot just be reduced to, say, little parts or many different sort of sub-impersonal set of things. That means exploring also what it means to be a person matters. Exploring what it means to be a human matters. And in fact, it's no less worthy of a pursuit than, say, scientific discovery or space exploration or the nature of the universe or metallurgy or engineering. The absolute and personal God legitimizes both of these pursuits. In fact, I would even argue, and this is an opinion, but a Christian education, and you can define that however you want, a Christian education that puts all of their eggs in the STEM basket is a sign that they've lost some of their story. They've lost some of their story either to the vast universe, and this place is just a combination of matter, time, and in space, or most likely they lost their story to the marketplace or competition or something like this, most likely. And here's what I mean. And that's also true the other way around. A Christian education that only says all we do here is read the Bible because Jesus is most important to us is also a sign we've lost our story. And what I mean is this story, the Bible story, doesn't only justify a third-person description of things. This story doesn't only justify third-person descriptions of the universe or science or math. This story also justifies first-person experience and experiences. This story also justifies not just nouns, but we would also say this story also justifies novels. This God justifies both of those because all things have been created by him. This story justifies what we could call turbines, test tubes, and telescopes, and the images we get from them. But this story also justifies the arts, and the humanities, and music, and poetry, and literature, because both the sciences and math and the humanities and the arts, they all things, get their legitimacy and dignity and value from the exact same source. And here's what I'm really trying to get at. Science can never say that it holds all the mysteries, because there's still someone behind all of those mysteries, a concrete personality. No more than we could say the arts and the sciences can, or the arts and humanities can just dismiss the sciences. The Christian story has always, this God of this story has always held both of those things together, because this God is behind both of them. And the truth is, most stories of the world will force you to choose. You see this in academic disciplines. They force you to go, are you going to go the impersonal, vast universe route, or are you going to go the deeply personal route? But this is also true with people you meet. They'll chain themselves. They'll chain themselves to one or the other. They'll overemphasize one or the other. They'll either chain themselves to the absolute, they'll chain themselves to the impersonal, the inflexible, rational logic that guides everything, or they'll chain themselves to simply the deeply personal. And you see this. They'll chain themselves to casting themselves adrift, to the spontaneous, to the impulsive, to the YOLO, to the sometimes dangerous swings of emotion, or maybe some mushrooms now and again. But making a choice to go in either of those directions, the deeply personal route or the impersonal route, is actually unbiblical. And it's a sign that we have a lopsided view of reality, a lopsided view of who God is, but also, I would argue, a lopsided view of who he has made you and me to be. Because the God of this story never forces you to choose between science and math at the cost of the arts, literature, humanities. He never forces you to choose between the social and the interpersonal at the cost either of the hardcore sciences. And this is something you'll want to pocket away for later. The God of this story never forces you to choose between law and love, ever. The laws of the universe and relationship. He'll never force you to choose arithmetic over others, because the God of this story is the source of both of these. He's the source of, again, not just you, he's the source of the universe, in whom John here says, without whom nothing that we see that is made would have ever been made. Let's pray, shall we? Our Father, Son, and Holy Spirit God, we bless your name. You filled the world, you have, and we see this, with both order and beauty, predictability, laws, and paintings, your paintings even, all around us. God, your presence can be seen in all of your works, the works of your hand. So we ask that you'd open our eyes to behold all things, to experience life with the richness and fullness intended for every one of us by you and you alone. That by rejoicing in all of your creation, the personal as well as the impersonal, we might learn to serve you with gratitude, that we might learn to serve you with thanksgiving and gladness for the sake of him through whom all things were made and without whom nothing would have ever been made. So God, grant us to be faithful unto death with the talents and gifts that you've entrusted to us. And might we live our lives in fervent service to you and you alone. And might we rejoice with those who rejoice, weep with those who weep. Might we patiently run the race that is set before us until the day when we cast our works of art, when we cast our scientific discoveries at your feet and hear you say to all, well done.